And I'm going to, the talk is going to be an explanation of the words in the title, starting backwards. Of course, we've all heard, and some of us have obsessed about the possibility that string theory, despite being a unique theory in 10 or 11 dimensions, has an enormous number of metastable vacua. And the presence of this huge landscape has caused a great deal of consternation and opened up a lot of questions that we have to try to understand. What I want to start talking about today, though, is that we actually haven't seen remotely the largest part of the landscape. I want to actually tell you about the part of the landscape that's definitely there. It's certainly the largest part that's ever been uncovered. And is an inescapable consequence of any theory that actually reproduces the standard model itself. So what I want to tell you is that even if that old dream that we could somehow stabilize, moduli, et cetera, and somehow get to the standard model as a unique effect of Lagrangian, Lorentzian effect of Lagrangian, even if that was true, that just taking the standard model Lagrangian itself, no exotic particles, nothing beyond the standard model, just the standard model of Lagrangian itself, together with the two additional ingredients that we realize are in the standard model effect of Lagrangian over the past 10 years, a small cosmological constant and non-zero neutrino masses, that with those ingredients, the standard model itself has an enormous landscape of vacua. Even taking the standard model as a theory with fixed parameters, very much like string theory is a unique theory that has zillions of solutions, the standard model is a unique theory that has zillions of vacua. And there's a landscape of lower dimensional compactifications of the standard model. And that's what I want to begin talking about. That's the first part of the talk, is telling you what that landscape is. It's incredibly simple. As you see, it's an extremely simple story. It has some interesting implications that we'll spend some time talking about. So that's part one. Part two, having shown you this essentially infinite moduli space of vacua in the standard model, now that it's in the standard model, you know, there aren't fluxes and brains and stuff like that. It's all in the standard model. In the standard model, we can now ask, how can we connect to these vacua? How can we see them? What physical processes allow us to transition? And so on. And as we'll see, the things that allow us to connect to these other vacua are associated with new kinds of black holes that can't exist classically, but necessarily exist quantum mechanically. So there are sorts of black holes that are impossible with standard classical assumptions about the nature of the energy momentum tensor, but which are all violated by the quantum effects that are going to give rise, in fact, the Casimir effect that's going to give rise to the vacua that I'm talking about. So there are new kinds of black hole and black string solutions that exist. And these black holes and black strings act as interpolators between our vacuum and these new vacuum. So that's something that at least I find very, very interesting. And I'll also draw some more general lessons from this, not for the landscape in the standard model, but the bigger landscape of going from 10 dimensions down to four-dimensional theories. We'll see that some of the ingredients that we're talking about, some of the ingredients that enter, are in fact a crucial part of the standard modular stabilization story, and that the standard part of the landscape will also be associated with new kinds of black holes that can't exist classically, but do exist quantum mechanically. Well, but do exist in the specific sense that we will talk about as I proceed. So I'll try to draw some more general lessons from this applicable for the whole landscape. Yes, John.
The reason you have black holes in classical parameters is because of Hoffman Penrose theory.
Right.
So why is the weak and strong
I suppose it's a non-energy condition which is being violated.
Right. Have
sure. We'll see specifically what I'm talking about as the things proceed. Okay, so let's talk about part one, the standard model landscape. Anyway, so it goes without saying, once you see that the standard model has a landscape, obviously, if you believe that the standard model is contained in string theory, then this landscape is also part of string theory without having to tell you how I get to the standard. All right, so let's imagine taking the standard model. It's a fixed Lagrangian. We know that there's a nice maximally symmetric solution. We have a positive cosmological constant, which is four-dimensional de Sitter space. Now, let's imagine taking the standard model and trying to compactify the standard model on a circle. If we compactify the standard model itself, take one of the directions and compactify it on a circle of radius r, then schematically, the low energy effect of Lagrangian, classically, if r is the radion field, looks something like this. This is what I get just from the compactification of the Einstein-Hilbert term. And then I get that from the cosmological constant. Now, as very familiar from all modular stabilization stories, it's very convenient to do a Weyl scaling of the metric to go to an Einstein frame where the Einstein term is canonically normalized. And if we do that, and I'm going to drop n points right and left here, what we get after that just rescales the entire potential by an overall 1 over RQ. So just believe me that is the case. So after the Weyl rescaling, which is g is 1 over r g hat, that Weyl rescaling takes you to canonical. Of course, there's also a d radion over r squared kinetic term coming from the Weyl rescaling. But I'm concerned with the potential. And so we see that there's some effective potential for the radion, which is lambda over r squared. Okay. So if we draw that, there's a runaway potential. OK. So in a world with zero cosmological constant, for example, classically, there would be a whole moduli space of solutions with different radius. But even classically, because we have the positive cosmological constant, there is no such thing. It's a runaway potential. And of course, it's runaway because the radius wants to decompactify. It wants to see that it's the Sitter space. It's expanding. That's the classical story. All the phenomena that I'm going to be talking about in this talk, I should have said at the start, are, of course, they're all non-supersymmetric. The standard model is not non-supersymmetric. But they're also all things that happen in non-supersymmetric theories where the cosmological constant is fine-tuned to be small. Okay. That's another property of our world. If this cosmological constant was the Planck scale, clearly this is an enormous potential. Right? And the universe would double in size in Planckian time. But the cosmological constant is very small. So that means that ordinarily subleading effects can become important and competitive. Okay. So there's a one loop correction. There's a one loop correction to this vacuum energy. And the one loop correction comes from the Casimir effect. We have some bosonic massless fields in the standard model, two polarizations of graviton and two polarizations of photon. So altogether, there are four polarizations of massless bosons. And the four polarizations of massless bosons give you a contribution to the one-loop effective potential that I'm not going to get the pi's right, but there's a minus 4 with some numbers out in front here, a minus 4 over r to the fourth. So this is 1 over r squared times what we would have called the four-dimensional potential. So that four-dimensional potential has a piece that goes like minus 4 over r to the, minus 4 over r cubed. Yeah, minus 4 over r to the fourth. Okay? Minus 4. Minus 4 over. Okay, so that this, so that the effective potential then, which we get by multiplying this whole thing by r and then dividing by r cubed, or sort of multiplying by 1 over r squared, is minus 4 over r to the sixth. And all that matters for my purposes is therefore that it's coming up from the cosmological constant, but then it turns down somewhere because there are different powers. If small enough r, it turns down. So this is CC, this is Casimir. Okay.
So you add them?
We add them, of course.
Yes,
okay. So that's the classical piece, this is the one loop correction. Okay.
So what about the contribution from the heaps?
Well, let's talk about that in a second.
Well, how do you define R?
Just the size around the circle.
Because you said, talk about the standard model.
This is the standard model compactified on a circle.
You talk about the standard model?
Yes, the standard model. The standard model.
You don't have to compactify something in four dimensions.
That's right. I'm not I'm taking our four-dimensional world and I'm compactifying our four-dimensional world. Okay. So that's right. This is one direction of the world is compactified on a circle. Okay.
Just a closed universe.
No, the other dimensions are infinite. Only one of the dimensions is compactified. All right. Okay. So far we just have some unstable maximum here. Okay. That's not too interesting. But this comes back to Jomit's question. Why have I neglected all the heavier particles? Well, because heavier particles, their contribution to the Casimir effect, the distance is large compared to their inverse mass, is exponentially small. They have to have a loop that goes around the circle. When the radius shrinks beneath the Compton-Wavelength of new particles, then they start contributing to the Casimir energy. Okay? So as we go to shorter distances, there are additional contributions to the Casimir. The first new particles that we hit are the neutrinos. Okay. Before talking about the neutrinos, what is this length scale, roughly? That the scale where this turns over is just clearly the length scale of the cosmological constant, because the Casimir energy doesn't have a scale in it. So this is around, roughly speaking, a millimeter. The spin around happens at roughly a millimeter. Now, very interestingly, the neutrinos have a mass of around a millimeter. Okay. In fact, it's slightly bigger than an inverse millimeter. Okay. So that means that we actually get to hit this crossover point. Actually, we don't know the full spectrum of neutrinos, but let's take the minimal theory, inverted hierarchy, Majorana neutrinos that explain solar and atmospheric neutrinos. Okay. Then they are then the neutrinos are heavier than this scale. So we get an additional contribution to the Casimir. So this is gravity plus photon. We get an additional contribution to the Casimir from the neutrinos. Now we have to talk about something. Because for fermions, there's a choice to make for whether the fermions are periodic or antiperiodic around the circle. Okay. If the fermions are antiperiodic around the circle, then the Casimir energy is also negative. In fact, let me talk about for the periodic cases, obviously the opposite sign is that, okay, because it's a fermion. So for the periodic, when R gets much smaller than M neutrino inverse, we see that there's a contribution from the neutrinos, which is positive, the same thing, 1 over R to the 6th, for V effective ultimately. Okay. But now there's how many polarizations of neutrino? There are 6 polarizations of neutrino. Even if they're Majorana particles, there's at least there's 3 neutrinos, 6 helicities. So there's a 6 in front of that form. 6 is bigger than 4. So what happens is that when we go to shorter distances, we see that the neutrinos kick in. And now if we take the absolute minimal model of neutrino masses, the potential then looks like this. And there's a nice stable. You have to make a choice, a uniform choice for one or the other, because there's no, especially with Majorana neutrinos, there's no global symmetry left over. Lepton number's broken, so the only choice that you can have is a uniform plus or minus for all the fermions. If the neutrinos are Dirac, it's a much more complicated, well, it's a more involved story, and I'll come back to talk about that in a second. Let's just talk about the case where the neutrinos are Majorana. Okay, if it's antiperiodic, so this is if it's periodic. And if it's antiperiodic, of course, the potential is still negative 1 over r to the 6th. And so it just keeps going like that. And there is no other difference. So this d2 is going to be important for us a little later. Okay, so but here we are. And this is around, let's call it 100 microns. Not quite a millimeter, a little smaller than a millimeter.
So how is this scale determined?
Sorry? That's basically the mass of the neutrino. Because at large distances, this contribution is exponentially small. As soon as you cross 1 over m, the potential turns on. And that's why we get this rapid turnaround 6 is bigger than 4, so there's a minimum. That's, this is basically M neutrino inverse. Okay. And I'm not being too specific. I mean, what we did is really put in numbers for the atmospheric and solar neutrino masses and really work it out. So I'm telling you the answer. But this is why it works.
So neutrinos and masses.
Neutrino masses. This is not happening. Okay. Exactly. So let's pause then to just. So what have we seen? We've seen that. Despite the fact that we have lambda bigger than zero in our universe, okay, the standard model has an ADS3 cross S1 minimum, an ADS3 cross S1 vacuum. Okay. Again, this happens only because the cosmological constant is fine-tuned to be small. Otherwise, the quantum effect could never compete with the classical. Okay, but when the CC is fine-tuned to be small, this can happen. Now, this is for minimal neutrino masses, minimal model of neutrino masses. If the neutrinos were Dirac, for example, then there are many more species of neutrino. They can come in at a variety of different. They can come in a variety of different scales. So the picture could look either like that, or like that. So we might even have DS3 cross S1 vacua as well in this case. Okay. And I'll come back to talking about that a little later. But let me focus a little time talking about the ADS3 cross S1.
Sorry, you're back with Higgs. So you have
the Higgs is now even exponentially. The Higgs
so you stabilize it already.
Oh, the Higgs is, oh, I'm literally taking our, the standard, oh, that's right. And so the Higgs is all stabilized, and so the Higgs is irrelevant for this Casimir because it's e to the minus 100 GeV times R. Yes?
You just make some assumptions to get to this point. Because normally when you just try to calculate,
right, so I'm saying that, I'm telling you this is a solution of the standard model. This is a vacuum solution to the standard model. It's a vacuum solution. In fact, you're going to see in a moment, it's one of an infinite number. So basically, continuously infinite number. So it's just like string theory. String theory is unique. It's a unique theory in 10 dimensions. It has zillions of vacuum. The standard model, just as a theory, is a unique theory. It has zillions of vacuum. Okay. Yes?
I have a question. If you look at this picture dynamically, if you go back before,
Phase
transition, then
you
would have to include the gluons.
So let me stress this point as often as I can. This is what's beautiful about the Casimir. It only cares about anything that's heavier than some scale makes an exponentially small contribution to the Casimir.
Yeah.
So this potential, I've only drawn what this potential looks like around here. You can ask, what does it look like much further on? And in fact, it has an interesting structure that I don't want to talk about. Okay, so when you go above the QCD scale, you have to worry about that. When you go above the weak scale, you've got to worry about that. Whatever comes beyond the standard model of the TEV scale, you've got to worry about that. All of those things affect the structure of this potential at tinier radii. None of it affects the presence of this minimum around the neutrino mass scale.
But if you follow it, when the universe evolved, so a priori.
This is not our vacuum. This is not our universe. I'm not talking about cosmology in this universe.
Okay.
If I want to talk about cosmology in this, I'm finding a landscape of solutions in the standard model. No. A landscape of other vacuum. That's right.
Okay.
Now, it's a vacuum solution. Then it's a question of how we connect to this vacuum solution, and I'm going to talk about that in the second half of the talk. Yes?
So I have two related questions. So, if I was doing this in four dimensions, and I wrote the whole effective potential is through a lot of terms in the Kolmogorov mechanism. I don't think you would get this with the standard model, but there are certainly K series coupled to masses fermions where you get this kind of thing.
Well, sure, what are you talking about?
Just the effective potential in just ordinary P plus 4 dimensions.
Right.
Right, so there's the old dynamic symmetry breaking mechanism.
Sure, we know that there are four dimensional theories that have, there are four dimensional theories that where there's some effective potential. And that's the typical mantra, right? Especially in non-supersymmetric theory, any flat directions are lifted, and there's a unique vacuum, or maybe a few vacuum. Okay? What I'm showing you is that the standard model is a four-dimensional non-supersymmetric theory par excellence, has I've shown you one vacuum, in a second you're going to see it's essentially an infinite number of lower dimensional vacuum. It's really completely parallel with 10-dimensional string theory. Yes?
If you do space-time, you know there's an infinite number of vacuums here. One of them is the punch tables.
Right. I'm not talking about that. I mean, these all look like canonical Minkowski space at short distances.
So it's all Minkowski.
It's all Minkowski space at short. It's all the flat space at short distances. Yes.
Stability issues and all
things. No. Well, I just showed you the effective potential. In fact, let me summarize some things. So there's one modulus here, the radius modulus. Let me make a few comments. So first, the ADS3 length is big, much bigger than a millimeter. It's like the size of a galaxy. The size of the extra dimension, R, is around a millimeter, let's call it. So this really looks like a compactification. It's not like other cases you're familiar with, like ADS5 cross S5, where the curvature scale of the ADS and of the S5 are the same. Here, really, the radius is much smaller than the curvature scale of the extra dimensions. The mass of the radion is around the ADS length, though. So this is indeed a very shallow potential. As you would expect, it's coming completely from quantum effects. It's a very shallow potential. So the mass of the radion is around the ADS. Okay, so let me say one more thing.
You spoke to alpha 6. How do you normalize it to get the potential?
Sorry, there are M planks in that. I didn't put the M planks in the biology scale. But there are M planks in that, of course. Yeah. Okay. So before pausing to draw some very obvious conclusions from this, I told you about one modulus, the radius modulus. There's one other modulus when you compactify the standard model on a circle. That other modulus is the Wilson line of the photon going around the circle. Okay. So there's theta, which is the integral of dz around the circle. Okay. Now this is an interesting modulus because of course it gets a potential. But where does it get a potential from? It gets a potential from charged particle loops that wrap around the circle. So the potential for this Wilson line comes from a diagram that looks like that, where what runs around the circle is the electron. Therefore, the potential goes like e to the minus m electron r times, let's say, cosine theta. I don't even care about the sign. Okay? Because the number m electron r is like 10 to the 8. So this is e to the minus 10 to the 8 cos theta. This is the flattest potential other than dead flat supersymmetric theories that we've ever seen. Okay? This is such a flat potential. Yes, in principle it has a minimum. But if you put it at any value of theta, the time scale it would take for it to relax at the minimum is e to the 10 to the 8, and it doesn't matter what the units are. Okay? To the extent that we care about metastable De Sitter vacua, because they're metastable, because they're long, long-lived, each and every value of theta qualifies as a metastable, long-lived vacuum. Okay? So we don't just have one vacuum. We essentially have a continuous infinity of vacua labeled by the value of the Wilson line.
I just have one question. You keep talking about this not exactly across the space time.
No, at short distances, at short distances, it's all.
Just a minute. I mean, when I do standard model calculations, I don't have to define the vacuum.
So do I. Yeah.
That's a unique thing, then I do all the calculations.
Sure.
And I get agreement to call this.
Right.
So when does all this fit in?
I'm taking that same theory and I'm doing a different calculation with it. And I could also calculate some things to 12,000 places. But it's just the standard model.
So it's the standard 12,000 place agreement.
Of course not. This world isn't the same as our world. But if you just hold on to that for a second, I'll have something relevant to say about that just in a second. Okay. By the way, just a parenthetical remark. Since this is such a tiny number, you might want to really be sure that it's exponentially small. Why don't we get an effect, let's say, from diagrams where the electron doesn't wrap around the circle, but the photon does wrap around the circle. So you don't have to pay an e to the minus mr. And this is for a simple reason, that if we integrate out just the electrons, what we get is some local theory for f mu nu. And a gauge theory, where Lagrangian is really just explicitly a function of f, has an extra symmetry than just gauge invariance. It has a shift symmetry on the vector potential, a goes to a plus constant. And it's that shift symmetry which protects against generating any Wilson law. The only thing that breaks that shift symmetry are minimal coupling to charged particles. So we really need to see a loop going around the circle. And therefore, the answer is always has an e to the minus m electron r. Okay, so so we've seen that the standard model has a basically continuous infinity of ADS3 cross S1 vacua labeled by the Wilson line. Okay. So even if we manage to just get the standard model as a unique theory out of some more fundamental theory, there's still a major vacuum selection problem. Because these are all other perfectly good vacua of the standard model. Why aren't we there? I want to make another comment. So another comment about this, which is that obviously this vacuum looks very different than ours at large distances. But since the radius is around a millimeter or 100 microns, the properties, the short distance properties of this vacuum in our world are basically identical. So particle physics looks identical. Atoms look identical. Little paramecians could live in this other vacuum. Short distance physics is identical. Quantum gravity is identical. Very short distance quantum gravity is identical in this world. Planckian scattering that makes black holes, or black holes that are 100 L Planck, or a billion L Planck. All these things look identical in this world as in our vacuum. Only when you get the energy so high that you would make black holes the size of a millimeter can you start telling a difference. So high energy physics is identical in this world as in our vacuum. In these worlds as in our vacuum. But the fact that these vacua are empty de Sitter has an obviously interesting implication. We normally say that ADS CFT is inapplicable to our world because we have a positive cosmological constant, but not in this vacuum. So this says ADS CFT says that there is some 1 plus 1 dimensional conformal field theory out there that's dual to the standard model plus whatever comes beyond it plus quantum gravity in this vacuum. That's a remarkable statement. Out there in the space of all 2-dimensional conformal field theories, there's some conformal field theory which describes not the standard model in our de Sitter vacuum, but the standard model in that vacuum. However, since all of high energy physics is identical in this vacuum as in our vacuum, that conformal field theory suffices to describe everything about high energy physics, the spectrum of the standard model, black hole formation and evaporation. All of those things, as long as the black holes are smaller than a millimeter, all those things are identical in this world as in ours, and so therefore there's some 1 plus 1 dimensional CFT out there with these properties. Okay. This is, of course, a very peculiar 1 plus 1 dimensional CFT. Let's talk about some of its operators. Okay. This is a 1 plus 1 dimensional CFT of the sort that we've sort of gotten used to thinking should exist from KKLT type constructions, except here we absolutely know they must exist now because we know that these solutions exist if we believe that the standard model exists as a solution of the real theory. So the spectrum of operators has a few operators of reasonable dimension. T mu nu, dual to the graviton, some U1 current, dual to the photon. There is a scalar, which is the radion, dual to the radion. Remember, the radion has a mass of order the ADS length. So that's so these are all operators of dimensions of order 1. There's a one very peculiar operator that's dual to the Wilson line. This is an operator that's not quite marginal, right? Because there's a tiny potential for the Wilson line. But the amount that it's not marginal is e to the minus 10 to the 8. Okay? Not quite marginal. By e to the minus 10 to the 8. And these are all the operators that have reasonable dimension. These are all like the single trace operator, where you could build multi-trace operators that correspond to many particle space like this, but the sort of single trace operators will look something like that. Then there's a huge gap. There's an enormous gap, and then you have operators of dimension of order 10 to the 30, I guess, corresponding to the neutrinos, Kaluza-Klein modes, okay, Kaluza-Klein modes on the circle. Then, of course, as you go way further up, there's some new sort of operators corresponding to the electron, the muon, the rho meson, the pi meson. Okay, there's a whole sequence of very, very high dimension operators that correspond to the entire rest of the standard. So this may suggest another way of trying to find trying to arrive at the standard model from a fundamental theory. You know, very often it's useful to have dials you can turn on the theories you're interested in to send them into a regime where things are more under control, large n. You know. This is a sort of a dial for the standard model. Okay. The standard model is a sitter space that's complicated. But this cousin vacuum of the standard model has some CFT door. And if we can understand, if we can hunt through and understand how two-dimensional CFTs can manage to give this miracle of getting this huge, huge gap in the spectrum, then that may be an alternate way in which we can make contact with the standard model, starting from two-dimensional conformal filters. Sorry, I should have also said the central charge of the CFT is obviously enormous, 10 to the 60. The ADS radius is enormous in finiteness. So this is clearly a very peculiar conformal field theory, but it exists. Yes?
If you truncate the Kaluza-Klein modes, so it's a dimensional reduction and not a magnification,
right.
Then this is 2 plus 1 gravity coupled to the standard model, dimension reduced, and that has a transign description, and that is dual to the conformal field theory.
Right. This is really a very different one, because those Kaluza-Klein modes are actually crucial. It's the Kaluza-Klein modes that make this a stable vacuum to begin with. If you like, the Casimir energies, a bad way of talking about them, but nonetheless a valid way of talking about them, is arises from precisely integrating out the Kaluza-Klein modes. So literally, a truncation would not work.
Why work for the first layer?
Yeah, I mean, why isn't that all the first layer of fields?
No, because the very existence of the vacuum depends on the Kaluza-Klein modes, depends on the neutrinos that have a mass.
But if I find the vacuum and I don't excite anything, then I truncate and describe the physics around that vacuum and truncate the Kaluza-Klein modes, then that is 2 plus 1 gravity coupled to some gauge fields and fermions and scalars. And that is a transcendence theory coupled to stuff. And that is dual to a conformal field theory.
Well,
are you not interested in that? Or?
It's not a consistent theory. It's not the. I guess I'm saying that there is no consistent truncation, because the Kaluza-Klein modes are crucial for the. How do I want to say this? Quantum mechanically, they're definitely very important. They're virtually important. I don't think there's a consistent truncation. But maybe you can convince me otherwise. Okay.
What you're trying to do is to say that after all, string theories are so bad because we
can. The standard model is as bad as string theories, yes.
Yeah. It was like you saw them all. But maybe that's just a red herring. Because standard model calculations are unique. That's the whole point. So you're saying they're not.
Of course they're not. I mean, they're never unique to begin with, in the sense that they're always solutions. I mean, they're always solutions, which is like you sitting there as a solution, or a black hole sitting there as a solution. There are always an enormous number of solutions to the equations. That was never in dispute. There was some hope that maybe solutions that have a well-defined symmetrical asymptota, vacuum solutions, might nonetheless be unique. So, for example, the standard model has zillions of solutions that are asymptotically flat space. You, me, black holes, elephants, okay? But there's a unique vacuum solution, which is asymptotically flat space. And the claim here is that that even restricting yourself to looking at maximally symmetric vacuum solutions, the standard model has zillions of vacuum.
The difference is, straight theory, the standard model, I know how to select the correct vacuum. I don't know if this is true.
I agree, of course, of course.
That's the whole point.
Right, but if you're a 10-dimensional person living in 10-dimensional space, you'd also know how to select the right vacuum. What I'm saying is that if someone handed you the standard model Lagrangian, you didn't know which world you lived in. If someone handed you the standard model Lagrangian, it would contain a continuous infinity of vacuum solutions, and you would have to start thinking about how to choose. Of course, we're very lucky. We know that, that's of course, in our case, we happen to experimentally be in that vacuum. But I'm saying from a theoretical point of view, the fact that, and you see, usually this is blamed on supersymmetry. Usually it's blamed on, oh, it's supersymmetry, which gives you all this, these moduli spaces, and supersymmetry that screws you up, and in a non-supersymmetric theory, we lift all moduli and their unique vacuum and so on. That's not true. In a non-supersymmetric theories, with a fine-tuned to be small cosmological constant, which is playing a critical role here. That's, I think, very interesting, that in the theory of natural CC, none of this happens. But with a cosmological constant fine-tuned to be small, even non-supersymmetric theories, the best non-supersymmetric theory we have, the standard model, has a landscape of four-dimensional vacuum.
So you're saying that you know that the symmetric vacuum is true here?
No, I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that since this happens in the standard model, since this happens in the standard model, now we can ask a lot of interesting questions about how we can connect these vacua to our vacua, how we transition between them, and this is a that's right. So I'm now going to ask these questions. So this is now transitioning to the second part of the talk. I'm going to ask these questions now, exactly these sort of questions. What is the relationship between these vectors? How do you connect them, and so on?
So in order to study this CFD, right, may also be useful to find the simplest theory.
Absolutely, of course.
This behavior.
Oh no, this is what I'm saying. In fact, I would love to go just totally the other way around, starting from. Oh, I'm sorry. You mean the simplest bulk theory?
Yes.
Oh, so on these grounds, let me make the following comment. That that what I just told you, we just saw it happen in the standard model as to the neutrinos and so on. This is a completely generic phenomenon. In any, as it turns out, in any, let's say you start with a supersymmetric theory, you spontaneously break Susie, and you fine-tune the CC to be small, you can prove that there's always an ADS 3 cross S1 cousin of the DS4 solution. And it has to do with the way bosons and fermions are split, the presence of the Goldsteinow and so on. So, but you can prove that the potential always has a dip where there's an ADS. So there's always an ADS cousin to a DS4 solution.
But you could also do it in higher dimensions.
So you could do it in higher dimensions. What's very important is that there is a CC, okay? And that's why, if you're going to try to do this in string theory, as far as I know, the only way we can do it right now, since the only way we've managed to get down to just the CC, is in four dimensions, okay? So there's all this work getting down to four dimensions with a hard cosmological constant rather than a runaway potential. Okay. Now, given the hard cosmological constant, then going down one more dimension is poof, there's this enormous set of vacuum. Okay, I think this is very, very generic. Of course, if you somehow manage to get to a hard CC in four or five dimensions, then, five or six dimensions, then,
right. If you look at six dimensions of the CC, you might be able to study better the dual CFD.
If you could manage to find a six-dimensional non-supersymmetric theory with a CC rather than runaway decay, okay? That's what the challenge is. I should say that this mechanism for stabilizing a radius was a very well-known and popular one in building models, models of the extra dimensions. Competing Casimir effects with bosons and fermions were used, for example, by many people, most recently by Eric Poppitz and Eduardo Pontan, in stabilizing six-dimensional brain world blah blah models. Okay. Of course, one of the reasons it didn't catch on a lot is because no one knew of theories where, in six dimensions, without supersymmetry, there was a small cosmological constant, which is crucial. Okay? That's a crucial property of our world. So it definitely happens in our world, and so this is a consequence. I should also say that just a few amusing things. I told you that it works because of neutrino masses. It's actually remarkable how close it comes not to working. So, if the neutrino masses were a factor of 3 smaller, 4 smaller, none of these vacuum would exist at all. Okay? So that's kind of amusing that the value of the neutrino masses seems to be, this is another interesting edge that some parameters are approaching. If they're very different, maybe these vectors would not exist. And a final comment along these lines is that it looks very peculiar that neutrino masses are so important. I could normally give a damn about neutrino masses. They're pretty boring. There's some dirty infrared physics. Who cares about it? Well, here they're playing a crucial role. Here they're playing a very crucial role. And the CFT, they have a very privileged position, right? They're the first operators of non-reasonable dimension. Okay? So why is it that something that we normally think from the bulk point of view is very irrelevant is playing such a very important role in the dual description? That's UVIR. That's what's so interesting about ABS-CFT. Okay? So it could be that the neutrinos actually are critical, that neutrinos play a very important role in the world. The dual neutrinos in the CFT play a very important role in the construction of this conformal field. What I thought you were going to say, Freddie, is that it would be interesting to find the simplest toy examples of two-dimensional CFTs which exhibit this gap. And that's, two-dimensional CFTs are under a fair amount of control. So it would be very, very interesting to try to find the simplest theories that do this. Of course, people have tried for a while without much success, but I think this is some additional inducement to a big gap.
And the usual one, actually, there is no big gap.
That's right, of course. Why would there be a big gap? And why would it be a big gap of like 10 to the 30? It's insane. But it must exist. Such a two-dimensional CFD, non-supersymmetric CFD must exist. Let me make one final comment before talking about interpolating the quantum horizons part of the talk, which is that what about the stability of these vectors? Of course, they're perturbatively stable. What about the non-perturbative stability of these vectors? There's no obvious reason when I draw this effective potential, let's say it just keeps going up like that. There's no obvious reason for that vacuum to be unstable. But you might think that it's non-supersymmetric. Maybe it shouldn't be exactly stable. And certainly, because microscopically, this looks like our four-dimensional vacuum. And if we expect our four-dimensional vacuum to be unstable to some tunneling out into a higher dimensional part of the landscape, that should happen here as well. So it's an interesting question. What does that instability look like from the CFT point of view? Because this is something which is perturbatively, asymptotically ABS. But the ABS space has some finite lifetime, exponentially long, but finite lifetime. What would that mean from the dual CFT point of view? I think it would mean that it's not really exactly a CFT, and that there's some small non-perturbative fact that makes the theory ill-defined. We're very familiar with this from the matrix models, for example. Okay, so there at some e to the minus n level, the whole theory doesn't make sense, and all the eigenvalues drain out to the runaway part of the theory. So not only are we looking for some interesting two-dimensional conformal field theory with a huge gap in the spectrum, but also at some non-perturbative level, some e to the minus n or e to the minus n squared or something like that level, it's got to be ill-defined. It's got to have some runaway directions. It's got to be non-perturbatively badly defined. And that reflects the underlying instability tunneling out into 10 dimensions and so on. OK, any questions about this?
What is the time scale at the time for all that?
Sorry?
But what is the time scale of the panel for?
Oh, I'm going to talk about exactly that right now.
And also, what happens at target temperature?
I won't have much to say about that, but we can maybe talk about it a bit. So let me not go through. There are obviously ADS2 cross T2 compactifications. Going down to two dimensions has its usual peculiarities. Gravity is dynamical and so on. But anyway, there are ADS2 cross T2. There is T3 compactifications. And T3 is when the first sort of really new thing happens, because of course, as you know, when you go down, when you compactify all the dimensions, now the moduli don't have all positive kinetic terms. There's a famous Bronson kinetic term associated with the overall expansion of the universe. So this is an interesting quantum mechanical system now, going down just to 0 + 1 dimensions, where some of the moduli have positive kinetic terms, some of them have negative kinetic terms, and so the whole system has a just quantum mechanically, because of the finite spread of the wave function, has a finite lifetime. Okay, but there are T3 solutions where all the radii are around a millimeter big, and they sort of oscillate back and forth on a time scale longer than our Hubble. So they're still quasi-stable, everything sort of millimeter scale, but quantum mechanically oscillate. And a final comment. What about simple extensions of the standard model? If there's supersymmetry at the TEV scale, then it's easy to see that depending on the spectrum, there could be another couple of vacua with a radius of order 1 over a DEB. if there are axions, then there's something a little different. If there are axions, then I can demand that the axion wraps around the circle, okay, by some integer multiple of 2 pi times. And this gives me a contribution to the potential that if the axion decay constant is f, is f squared over r squared times n, the number of times, the number of times it's wrapping around. So now, so my potential looks like that. Now let me imagine that the fermions are negatively moted around the circle, so that the Casimir part just goes like this. Then eventually the axion piece takes over, though, at short distances. And again, we get ABS3 cross S1 vacua. But this time, they're labeled by yet another discrete integer, n. And that n can take a range of values from 1 to 10 to the 40. let's say that f is like 10 to the 12 GeV, or even the Planck scale, it doesn't matter, some very short distance scale. Then these vacua start at very tiny distances. And then as you ratchet up n, they just go bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger distances. But there's an additional huge number of vacua just labeled by the axion flux. Okay? This is like a flux convective equation where the axion is when we roll up the flux. Okay. So, lots of vacua. So part two is how do we connect to the vacuum? The question you ask is what's the tunneling rate? And that's the way that we've gotten used to answering to asking this question. But a little bit of thought makes it clear that there's no way you're tunneling to lower dimensions. Okay? It can't look like some kind of Coleman-DeLuccia bubble, which then expands and then inside the universe is lower dimensional. Just a little bit of thinking about the geometry makes that makes it clear that that doesn't make any sense. Bubbles of nothing are an exception to this. Okay, but there's certainly no way of actually tunneling down to these lower dimensional, not in the usual sense. Instead, it's actually it's different. And in order to motivate what it looks like, let me tell you about one set of vacua of the standard model that I could have that have been known since antiquity. I told you about these exotic S1 vacua with Casimir energies and all of that stuff. But there's a whole infinite class of lower dimensional vacua of the standard model that we've known about for ages. Imagine taking the standard model and compactifying on a sphere. If we compactify on a sphere, then if we look at the potential for the radion, there is a negative contribution to the potential coming from the curvature of the sphere. Okay? And so we wouldn't find a solution unless we turn on some flux through the sphere. So if we turn on now just ordinary electromagnetic flux through the sphere, then we get a nice stable minimum. So this is an ADS2 cross S2 flux compactification of the standard model. The picture for the radion potential looks identical. There's one important qualitative difference between the case I was talking about before, which is that this potential is very steep. This contribution is coming from the Einstein-Hilbert term, so there's a 1 over g newton in front of it. The whole potential is much steeper, and the mass of the radion here is actually of order 1 over r. Well, that's exactly what I'm saying. Okay, that's exactly what I'm coming to. Okay, so here, but view it as a lower dimensional vacuum. Viewed as a lower dimensional vacuum, this is one with a very stiff potential, the radion mass of order 1 over r, rather than what we had in our case, where the radion mass was of order a galaxy when r was a millimeter, that reflecting the much shallower Casimir potential. But anyway, there's an infinite number of two-dimensional vacuum of the standard model of this form, completely classical two-dimensional vacuum of the standard. Now, how do we connect to these vacua? We don't talk about tunneling to them. The way we connect to them is just what Lee said. if we have an extreme old Roger Nordstrom black hole, an extreme old Roger Nordstrom black hole is such that asymptotically it opens up into a flat four-dimensional space, but the near horizon geometry is ADS2 cross S2. Of course, and you know, string theorists are very familiar with this, and for many reasons, and also the same thing happens with the D3 brain geometry, the near horizon geometry is ADS5 cross S5. Okay. So we don't normally say it in such picturesque terms, but extreme black holes are interpolators. They let you go from one vacuum to another vacuum. You should think about extreme black holes as like the solitons that that take you from one gravitational vacuum to another. Okay. And this happens perfectly, beautifully, classically in for these classical vacuum. So these classical vacua that we can, let's say no one ever told you about extreme horizon from black holes, you're interested in lower dimensional theories, you would quickly run into these compactifications. But these compactifications have an extension. Okay? They have an extension to a whole extreme black hole that then connects these vacua to the asymptotic four-dimensional vacuum.
But immediately okay. Just they can actually split.
Sorry?
Immediately understood that they can split.
That's right. So ADS2 cross one of the, and that's one of the peculiarities, of course, of ADS2. As you know, it's one of the things that makes CFT1 complicated. It's the whole story is complicated because of that. Okay. But anyway, just as a classical solution, it certainly exists. And the ADS5 cross S5 case, you're of course very familiar with. There's no such there's nothing in that case. I just also wanted to say, and of course, there are also non-extremal versions of these things. Okay? So if I heat this whole thing up a little, I'll have a non-extremal version that has a horizon somewhere. Okay. Heat it up a lot, the horizon will come up. Okay. But given that picture, it's very natural to expect, therefore, that all of these other vacua have to have some such object associated with them that interpolates, analogous to the extreme black hole. Okay. There should be some object that asymptotically looks like, let's say, of course, we have the De Sitter space, but for the rest of the talk, let me just imagine that I put back quantum constant to zero, okay, just for simplicity. I'll come back to it at the very end. But in the near horizon geometry, they look like these lower dimensional vacua. Of course, these objects don't exist classically. What would they look like in four dimensions? In four dimensions, let's say in these ADS3 process 1 vacuum, it would look like not a black hole, but a string, okay? Because it's an S1. So it would look like something where far away, just think you have a cosmic string, but as you approach the cosmic string, you realize, hey, wait a minute, there's this whole ADS3 process 1, which is opening up. Well, these things don't exist classically. There's no such thing as S1 horizons in four dimensions. Okay, but of course, my vacua don't exist classically either. The Casimir effect is crucial for them. Okay? And something very important, the bosonic part of the Casimir effect was really crucial for them, because it's the bosonic part that gives you this, that gives you the negative piece of the energy that is needed to make those nice ADS solutions. The bosonic Casimir energy violates every energy condition in the book. It violates the null-energy condition. And of course, all the theorems about the kinds of horizons you can have in GR depend on those energy conditions. Okay. So we should then expect that there's some kind of black, new quantum black object, which has an extremal limit, which will look like ADS3 cross S1. Okay. And those objects exist, and I want to tell you about
them.
Yes. Well, you'll see. There are extremal versions. There are black versions. No, in this case, they really are black. It's not such a violent violation of the null energy conditions that they're naked singularities, right? Okay. And you'll see how they work. But before going on to this particular example, I just want to put it in a somewhat broader context. A famous fact about modulus stabilization in string theory is Malvasan and Nunez theorem. That said, that you can't stabilize moduli in string theory to get positive vacuum energy, unless in supergravity, And really what goes into that theorem is unless you violate the energy conditions. Okay? So a critical part of the entire modular stabilization story are somehow allowed violations of the classical energy conditions. In string theory, this is popularly done with orient dipoles. Okay, orient dipoles are sources of negative energy, but they're just okay because they don't fluctuate. They represent ends of space time. Okay? They violate the null energy condition, and that's why you can get modulus stabilization. Okay? The Casimir effect is playing the role of orient dipoles in my example. Okay? And my example is just smooth, everything smooth geometries. Of course, there are S1 mod Z2 versions. Obviously, zillions of vacua like this are focused on the simplest ones. But every modular stabilization story, interesting modular stabilization story, crucially involves the violation of these energy conditions. And therefore, just as I'm going to show you, new sorts of quantum black objects that interpolate between the vacua I've just described and flat space. So I really believe that all the interesting vacua in the landscape have to have such black partners that open up into that connect asymptotically flat 10 or 11 dimensional space to these other vacua as their near horizon geometries. And what allows this is, again, the violation of the energy conditions necessary in the stabilization of the module at the beginning. Yes?
The accelerating universe inflation violates strong energy conditions.
No, it's not the strong energy condition. Of course, there are many energy conditions that are violated. There's one energy condition which is not violated by anything sensible that we know of classically, which is the null energy condition. Okay? And what's crucial is actually the null energy condition. So there are many energy conditions. Most of them are kind of meaningless. The null energy condition has some meaning. And it's violated by very exceptional things. It's violated by orient dipole planes. It's violated by Hawking radiation. It's violated by the Casimir effect. It's never violated by a lot, but it's enough in our examples. Why is it enough in my example? Again, it's crucially because the cosmological constant is fine-tuned to be small. So a classical effect has been just by hand adjusted to be tiny, so a quantum effect can take over. Okay, so because time is short, let me just tell you what these solutions look like, because they're very simple to characterize. One big difference between the extremal black holes, the only qualitative difference between the extremal black holes and us, is that here the radion was heavy on the same scale as the geometry, and in our case the radion is light. What that means is that the mass of the radion should reflect the distance scale over which you interpolate between one vacuum and the other. Okay. Again, this is always true for a soliton. The thickness of a soliton is the mass of the Higgs, always. Okay. So because our radion is so light, our object isn't going to look like, for example, it's not going to look like a string that's just like a normal string and then poof, you go inside. This is what it actually looks like. Imagine taking a cosmic string. I'll tell you what these objects look like in going from 4 to 3 dimensions. Then I'll actually tell you analytically what they look like in going from 3 to 2. Because there, everything can be solved beautifully and exactly. And it's simple to just write the metrics down in closed form. And we can stare at some of what they mean, because it's interesting. So imagine taking a cosmic string. You know, if you take a cosmic string, that it makes a deficit angle in the surrounding space. But now imagine cranking up the tension of that cosmic string a lot. Keep cranking it up. You know, if you crank it up too much, so it's equal to 4 G Newton or whatever, some specific number, the space closes up completely. Okay? There's some critical tension for which the space closes up completely. Take it to that amount, but not quite. Okay? So I wanna crank it up so that the opening angle here is very small. Okay. Theta is very, very small. Now, when theta is very small, of course, this is eventually opening up into infinite four-dimensional space. The radius gets as big as you want eventually. But you see, locally, it starts looking like a lower-dimensional theory. Okay? At any given point, locally, it's as if the radius has some value and it's just very, very slowly changing. And by making the angle small, making the radius change very, very slowly, which as we just said, is necessary in order to get an interpolating solution. So this is what happens. If we make this angle for a very tiny angle, this comes in, it comes in, until the radius is around this stabilized radius. And then instead of continuing to the singularity, something happens which is classically forbidden. It opens up when ADS 3 plus S 1 is. Again, this is classically forbidden because classically you can't bounce because of the energy conditions. And it's exactly the violation of the energy conditions by the Casimir effect which is making this possible. This angle turns out to be, the value of this angle turns out to be 1 over R naught M Planck. So when the radius is big, this angle is really, really, really small. Okay? So what these interpolating solutions look like are really narrow cones, very, very narrow cones. You would infer them to be of Planckian tension from far away. But way before you reach any Planck scale in distance, when you find that the local radius becomes comparable to this stabilization radius, it connects smoothly to an ABS 3 cross S 1 solution. Yes?
So I just mean, what's the geometry of far away here?
The geometry, this is just a cone in Planck space. Okay? So I'll write down what the metrics look like explicitly in the tree, but this is really a cone. Imagine just taking the cosmic string geometry. So it's conical. It's just a cone. You would have a conical singularity at the origin. Quantum mechanically, the conical singularity at the origin is gone, and it's replaced by this ABS 3 cross S 1 throw. Now, this is an extremal black hole. Okay? If it's extremal, you should ask me what charge it carries. Because everything extremal should carry some charge. The charge it carries is the fact that for this to happen, you remember the fermions have to be periodic around the cone. And periodic fermions around the cone are an exotic choice. If you have a smooth geometry, as you know very well, if you have a smooth cylindrical geometry, let's say, then there's two spin structures that you can put on it. But the spin structure that corresponds to smooth wave functions for the fermions around the tip give you anti-periodic fermions around the circle, asymptotically. Okay? That's why anti-periodic fermions are they're very, very common to come by. Periodic fermions, therefore, carry a charge. They carry a Z2 charge, which is fermion number. So the charge that's stabilizing this extremal black hole is a fermion. It's distinguished by other cones by the minus sign, by the plus sign the fermions pick up as they go around the circle. Now, let me actually pause a second just go down one dimension. So I'm going from 3 to 2 dimensions, exactly the same thing happens. Okay. Now they're not strings, they're just point masses. Okay. And now exactly the same thing happens. As you get to sufficiently small distances, it gets replaced by a throat. Here I can write down the metric explicitly. It's possible to solve exactly, and I can write down the metric explicitly for a wide class of the situation. So let me write the metric in two forms. Here's the first form. R, capital R, turns out to be a satisfied equation as a function of little r, which is equivalent to particle motion in a potential that looks like that. In fact, it's equivalent to a potential that's like our, roughly, the radion potential upside down, as you would expect, because it's a solution in space and not in time. Okay. All right. So if we look at this, we see that if I start at the top of the hill here, and I fall down, asymptotically, I'll go to some finite velocity. So asymptotically, r of r goes to some theta naught r. Okay. Sorry, let me call it epsilon r. So r prime goes to epsilon. And anyway, asymptotically, you see, therefore, it's going to some constant times dt squared, which I can scale out of t, dr squared, and then it looks like epsilon squared r squared d theta squared. That epsilon there is the tiny opening angle. That's the deficit. But you see that the, near the top here, the metric is approximately that of a particle climbing up a harmonic oscillator. And then it looks like the ADS metric. That's like e to the minus 2r dt squared plus dr squared. Okay. That's the, in this case, the ADS2 metric. That's ADS2 process. Okay. That's one form of the metric. Now, this picture makes it clear that there are lots of other solutions that exist.
It's really cross.
You know, it's just like ADS5 plus as well. It's literally cross.
But the interesting thing, right. R goes like exponential about
it. R prime goes like, R prime is going to zero exponentially. R is going to the specific value. Okay, so that's why it looks like that. You see that there are a whole host of other solutions. For example, you can just start here and fall down. If you start here and fall down, that's something where r prime is going to zero, and r double prime is not going to zero. And what these solutions look like are the following. But if the opening angle is even smaller, then instead of either seeing a singularity or asymptoting the ADS, you just get a horizon. So for sufficiently tiny opening angles, this is a quantum horizon. And in fact, the geometry is identical to four-dimensional Schwarzschild. The TR geometry is identical to four-dimensional Schwarzschild. Okay. So for really tiny opening angles, you get the non-extremal version of the object. In fact, regardless of the moding of the fermion, tells you whether the potential turns around or keeps going like this. Regardless of the modeling of the fermion, these objects exist. These are quantum black holes in 2 plus 1 dimensions, quantum horizons in 2 plus 1 dimensions. Instead of having the conical singularity, the singularity is hidden behind a black hole horizon. These objects were discovered a number of years ago by M. Paran and Kalapur. In fact, they're roughly the ADS-CFT duals of black holes on Randall-Sundrum grades. Okay. This effect that in 2 plus 1 dimensions, the conical singularity gets smoothed out, at least when you couple it to a large NCFT, was noticed by these guys. Okay. So these quantum horizons existed in that very nice paper of Embraer and Kalapur from 2002, 2003, something like that. Okay. Going back to the black hole solutions found by Horowitz, I think maybe even Rob and other people before that. So this part of the phenomenon had actually been noticed before. This is very interesting in itself, because these black holes have a temperature, so that they have a radius that goes like whatever this theta is, that goes like theta to the minus 2 times the three-dimensional Planck scale. They have a temperature, which is interestingly theta over r, not 1 over r like ordinary Schwarzschild black holes. And they have an entropy, most interestingly of all, that just goes like 1 over theta squared. The entropy doesn't have an h-bar in it. The entropy doesn't have a 1 over h-bar in it. It doesn't have a g in it. And that's because the area itself has an h-bar in it. So the area in Planck units, the h-bars cancel. It should be possible to account for the entropy of these objects in an interesting way. It's at least very different from the standard non-supersymmetric black holes that we deal with. The realization that this is part of a bigger picture, and that and there are extremal versions of these objects exist, and those extremal objects are the interpolators between higher dimensional and lower dimensional vacua, adds something to this. Because even to this picture, which is that these black things, for one moding of the fermions around the circle, have an extremal limit. Of course, as you head towards that extremal limit, it goes from looking more like a Schwarzschild black hole in one higher dimension to looking like a BTZ black hole in the lower dimensional ADS space. But it has another important consequence, that because the extremal limit exists, there is a stable black hole that isn't Hawking evaporating now, that's sitting there, which has an entropy, which you should be able to count. And now because that extremal object exists and is stable, we can take a decoupling limit. As we take G to zero, the entropy stays fixed, and in that limit, the geometry just turns into a cone. I decouple gravity completely, holding the angle fixed, moving the fermions around the circle exotically, and I'm left with something with the same entropy, but with just the conical geometry. These are the brains. This is the analog of turning off the string coupling and seeing the black hole open up into a whole collection of d-brains. I don't know what lives at the tip of this cone, and if I did, I would have a microscopic theory for the entropy of these non-supersymmetric black holes. Okay? But I think this is an interesting start. It's at least non-extremal limits, I mean, extremal limits exist, they're stable, decoupling limits exist, so this might be a foot in the door to getting an understanding of black hole microstates in totally non-supersymmetric theories. Albeit leave for these somewhat exotic objects. So, sorry, what happens dynamically then with the normal side moding, this black hole Hawking radiates, Hawking radiation goes out, this angle opens up. Okay, the cone opens up and up and up. With the periodic moding for the fermions, it Hawking radiates, it opens up and up and up until it reaches this critical radius and then it settles down to this nice ABS geometry. Finally, a physical comment. Why do black holes exist physically? Well, physically, why don't they exist in 2 plus 1 dimensions? They don't exist because there's no long-range gravity in 2 plus 1 dimensions. You plonk down two masses, and there is no Newtonian limit. There's no attractive force between them because there's no dynamical gravity. However, despite the fact that there's no dynamical graviton, there is a famous, it's famous even in four dimensions, there's a famous one-loop correction to Newton's law in any number of dimensions when you have massless fields around. If you have massless fields around, there's a one-loop correction to Newton's law that's completely calculable with massless particles running around the loop. John Donahue enjoys calculating this in four dimensions. It's very beautiful. It's a prediction of quantum gravity that's completely independent of short-distance details. There's a, in four dimensions, for example, there's a calculable 1 over r cubed corrections to Newton's law. Okay, just this one loop diagram. We normally don't care in four dimensions because there's a much bigger piece. Okay. But you can engineer situations where this is the leading contribution to the force. For example, in four dimensions, if we take a pair of cosmic strings, then for a pair of cosmic strings, we know that the ordinary tree-level graviton exchange doesn't give us anything. Okay. And therefore, the only thing that's left, the leading thing that's left, is this one loop effect. Similarly, in three dimensions, there is no one graviton exchange at all, but this loop diagram induces a long-range attraction between masses, which in three dimensions is like a potential that goes like 1 over r. Okay. That's why you should expect to find black hole solutions, okay, because there is an attractive potential that goes like 1 over r between these objects. And depending on the moding of the fermions, when you get to shorter distances, they're repulsive or continuing to be more attractive, which is why you can or can't get extremal objects too. Okay? And that also explains, because it's 1 over r in three dimensions, it explains what I told you a moment ago, that the TR part of the geometry looks just like four-dimensional Schwarzschild. Of course it does, because the potential looks just the same as four dimensions.
What if that repulsive Casimir force, which could be very large?
Well, that's all included here. That's in fact really the sort of entire effect is that.
As
this angle opens up, you might find multiple places that you could. I've only described connecting to one vacuum. The radion potential might have multiple minima. And what would happen is that you would open up in many such solutions exist with different opening angles. And they could asymptote to different ADS geometries. Let me just, I'll just take 5 more minutes and I'll end, I'm sorry. But I do want to just talk about this too. There's another way of writing this There's another way of writing this metric that I find even more illuminating. Let me write it like this. Because it makes, I think, an interesting qualitative point. So now I'm using the radius itself, r, in front of d theta squared. V of r is that picture of the potential that I was just drawing for you a moment ago. Like that. And remember, this was r prime squared. So r prime squared is like the kinetic energy of the particle. So that's, I've written the energy minus potential. And that's what r prime squared is. Okay. Now, in this form of the potential, it looks a heck of a lot like Schwarzschild. I mean, it's very, very, very familiar form. But I want to point something out. Where do we see just the vacuum solution when I write the metric like this? See, the vacuum solution has a unique value of the radius, whereas clearly here it's just by fiat. The radius is taking all possible values. So how do I see what I before called the vacuum solution? What I called before the vacuum solution corresponds to picking the energy such that you're just grazing the top of the hill here. And by doing that, you're really zooming in on the region right around r equals this r0. What happens technically is that in that fluctuation, there's a dr squared over some epsilon. You can rescale everything so that what we called the vacuum solution before is literally what I said. It's literally zooming in on that part of the solution. But you see, that's a very unnatural thing to do from the point of view of the whole solution. The whole solution actually exists. Of course, there are other solutions. There's like the one where the energy is there, and that's what I just talked about. Those are the interesting black holes that I just talked about, the non-extremal versions of these things. But let me finally talk about the last topic, which is how we connect the De Sitter vacuum. I didn't talk about, these were all the ADS vacuums. You might be interested in how we could connect to the lower dimensional De Sitter vacuum. And again, since this picture of the potential is roughly turning upside down our previous picture, here is an unstable De Sitter maximum. But I'm gonna focus it on it anyway. One of the reasons is that in 2 plus 1 dimensions, there's no dynamical metric. So the instability doesn't work the way it intuitively works in higher dimensions. There are no perturbative instabilities associated with this. But I just want to illustrate a point. So in a potential like this, this is clearly a special solution that corresponds to going to the ADS space. These are like the black hole solutions. But now clearly something interesting happens when the energy drops beneath a value to which you can escape to infinity. Okay. So if I use the energy in these solutions, then just as zooming in up around here was the ADS3 vacuum, zooming in right around there is the DS3 vacuum. Okay. But again, it continues away from there. It's very simple to see what the Penrose diagram looks like corresponding to this interesting critical solution that interpolates to the the three-dimensional flat space outside. It looks like this. This is the eternal Penrose diagram. So what it looks like from the outside And what the radius is doing everywhere here is the radius is going to infinity here. It's going to a small value there, and shrinking and then bouncing because of this chasm here. So out here, it looks like a shrinking and bouncing cosmology. Okay, flat Minkowskian cosmology. But at some critical time around the bounce, as it bounces, there's another region opened up in the geometry, which looks like this inner space. This is really just one, it's really a causal patch of this inner space. Okay? It contains one entire causal patch. It's interesting because it's a way of realizing this inner space that does not have these horizontal lines in the Penrose diagram. It doesn't have the eternal inflation part. Okay? And yet, locally, the geometry is dead sitter. Okay? Locally, it just looks like there is a causal patch of the sitter space. Okay? This is, again, an unusual way of realizing, it's an interesting way of realizing the sitter. I suspect it has, again, to do with the violation of the energy conditions. But it's still something that we are thinking about. But regardless, you see that there's one very simple set of solutions that interpolates between the extremal black hole, extremal quantum black holes, and these interesting realizations of this sitter. A final comment. This was all because I told you I would promise. I promised to tell you how we connect to these vacua. Here's at least one process that allows us to connect to them. So, suppose you're going to ask the analogous question, how would we go from our four-dimensional vacuum to these ADS2 cross S2, the classical ADS2 cross S2 vacuum? Well, one way is you just, you know, smash, you build an accelerator, and you pair-produce extremal black holes. If you pair-produce extremal black holes, then you go in the neighborhood of one of them, and you say, it's ADS2 cross S2. If you live in the sitter space, which we do, one of the motivating things about thinking about these things for me was that you know that starting from the sitter space, because it has a finite entropy, you can go anywhere. Okay? You should be able to transition physically from the sitter space anywhere. So let's say, again, we're talking about the normal ADS2 cross S2 cases. We can transition from the sitter space to these ADS2 cross S2 vacua by having thermal de Sitter fluctuations pop out an extremal black hole, anti-extremal black hole pair. Okay? That's the way this transition should happen. So what does it look like in our universe? In our universe does not contain one of these cosmic strings, clearly, because you know we don't have this giant deficit angle. Okay? However, this solution opens up at this tiny angle, and outside, it's cut off by the de Sitter horizon. Okay. So there's some solution that asymptotes to 4D de Sitter with this large deficit. Okay. This whole solution has some de Sitter entropy. It has a much tinier de Sitter entropy than our de Sitter entropy because of the big deficit. But it has some non-zero de Sitter entropy. And so there is some non-zero amplitude of order e to the minus the de Sitter entropy differences between our de Sitter entropy and this de Sitter entropy to spontaneously create a string anti-string pair. Okay? It's a minuscule amplitude, yes, absolutely minuscule amplitude, but there is some amplitude in the sitter space, parametrically faster than the recurrence time. Okay? There's some amplitude to spontaneously pop out a string anti-string pair. Well, and if you do that, interestingly, unlike Coleman-DeLuccia bubbles, where after the bubble nucleation, nobody survives, right? You know, here, you might imagine being a little paramecium. This sudden transition happens. All of a sudden, the de Sitter space around you is compressed with this huge deficit angle, two of them, in fact. Okay. But you can survive this transition. The world around you hasn't changed very much. And in fact, generically, you'll even make non-extremal versions of these things. You'd wait for them to evaporate away and settle down to their extremal versions. And then you could wander around and see, hey, this is a nice three-dimensional active. We're definitely physically connected to these vacua. Okay. There are physical processes that can take us, tunneling processes that can take us from our vacuum to this vacuum, where some things can survive. Little paramecia could easily survive. Okay. So they're definitely not metaphysical vacua. Now, the de Sitter vacua are always more interesting. Okay. The and let me just let me close with this. You can start with ADS vacua, and we know, and as is done in string theory, you start with ADS vacua, and you uplift them to get the sitter vacua. You uplift them by adding something, adding some source of positive energy. Well, in these solutions, we can actually, because now they have an asymptotic region, we can imagine whether we could actually do that physically. So imagine you have one of these ADS vacua sitting there. And you say, I want to make a de Sitter vacuum. So I'm going to grab some piece of positive energy. I'll grab a brain. And I'll literally, you know, when we say you throw in D3 brains, D3 bars, you literally would throw them in here. You're like, take a brain from the outside, you would chuck it in. Do you get the de Sitter solution? Of course, absolutely not. Because the ADS solutions in this picture, the ADS solution would look something like this. We would have a solution that goes up here and which does reach asymptotia. So even if we quickly change the potential, so it goes from there to there, I still have this in this affected part of the problem, positive energy. I don't see the de Sitter solution. I see a black hole. I see one of these quantum black holes. So that's one of the usual issues, going back to the work of Guth and Fahey, that spontaneously creating these other universes, always from the outside, looks like you're making a black hole. Here we see much more specifically, you just do not match on to the solution that interpolates to the de Sitter space. Okay? So there's still an interesting mystery about how we interpolate to the de Sitter solutions. However, the fact that at least some of these Penrose diagrams look a little different than we're used to makes it possible to think that there might be more interesting ways of being able to connect to the higher dimensional space and realize the sitter in this way. Maybe our universe looks something like this. Maybe we're not part of some giant eternally inflating Penrose diagram. Maybe we're a little sitter pocket in the higher space of the landscape. And I want to emphasize again this little apparently technical point that these sort of classically exotic things, which are allowed because of violating the energy conditions, it's interesting that they're in correspondence with what it takes to stabilize the moduli. So we've been thinking in a very vanilla garden variety way about what the higher dimensional space might look like. But the interpolating solutions, like when we say we tunnel out into 10 dimensions, you really think you tunnel out into some 10-dimensional flat space. It's probably not like that. There's probably some more antipodes sitting there in the 10-dimensional space. And there's probably an interesting black object that can interpolate in the presence of that more antipode from the 10-dimensional flat space to the lower dimensional geometries, where the near horizon geometry will look very complicated. It will look like Calabi-Yau with fluxes and all of that crap turned on. But these will be consistent solutions of gravity in the presence of these orientable poles. So this is just a general fact that vacua are equipped with a lot more data than just the structure of the lower dimensional theory. There is this interpolating solution. There's some interpolating solution to look for. And therefore, there's additional things about the vacua associated with what an observer at infinity might be able to see that should certainly play some role in our characterization. OK, I'm sorry I went on so long. Thanks a lot.
I expected you to remind us by saying to some running this down from 10 dimensions that this is why the cosmological constant is so light and the neutrino masses are at the same scale.
Well, I mean, it's the usual fun UVIR thing about ADS-CFT. Suppose I came into the talk and said, here is a two-dimensional conformal field theory. Here is some 2D conformal field theory. Look, I'm computing. Here we go. Here's the spectrum of operators. Here's this huge gap, and so on. That's an isolated theory. It makes sense by itself. Maybe not for this exponential, some exponentially small effect, but that theory, there would be no, you know, it's just the cosmological constant being small is an input parameter in that theory. Central charge is huge. The neutrino masses have the value they have. That's just part of the definition of the theory. So this is the usual UVIR flipping on its head of what we think is fundamental and what we think is an output. So had I just handed you that conformal field theory, now then you could have asked me, why did you choose that conformal field theory and not some other conformal field theory? And that's where the vacuum selection questions comes in, would come in again. But indeed, so now minimally, you know, minimally the statement, the standard model has these, that our vacuum has very close cousins, which don't have all of the confusions associated with our vacuum, not the De Sitter horizon, not all of that stuff, makes it, and which yet nonetheless, you know, in this ADS space, a short distance observer can determine that there is a cosmological constant in the four-dimensional vacuum that has a small value. Okay? I think that this might be a slight deformation of our world, which is a little more accessible to a theoretical understanding. It might be, and I think it's worth thinking.
Well, I think that if you have the time, maybe we can respond to further questions for lunch.
Sure. Sorry again for going so long.
Okay.